Well, good to be with all of you, as I said, and today I wanted to talk about something along the lines that we'll call teamwork. But I want to put a little spin to this. I want to talk about it in the framing and in the setting of marriage. Because marriage is a team relationship. It really is. Now, with those of you who are not married, I don't want you tuning out on me here, so look at it from this standpoint, because the principles we're going to be talking about can be applicable easily to every relationship that one might be able to entertain and have opportunity to engage. It just so happens today, in this particular case, I'd like to, for those of us who are married amongst us, to focus especially on these principles and how they apply to the interpersonal relations between husband and wife. Because I think it's very important that we do take some time out occasionally to address certain things concerning our marriages. Because quite frankly, a lot of what is going on around us today, the decay, the decline, the sad situation that we're all experiencing and finding ourselves now more than we'd like to admit surrounded by such violence, is nothing more than an illustration of the breakdown of family. And it's sad. Nobody's addressing that. Nobody's addressing that. Everybody's addressing what is being used, such as guns or chainsaws or baseball bats or knives even, for that matter. But the point of it is that the reality and what causes these behaviors in so many cases, quite frankly, simply, I don't want to oversimplify it, but certainly is a major contributor to it, is the dysfunctionality of the family and the breaking down of those relationships within that unit, within that embryonic environment that should be nurturing, it should be educational, it should be fundamental to the development of the personalities of the little ones. So when they grow up and they see a gun even loaded in the house, they don't touch it. I referenced some weeks ago, my father-in-law used to have a loaded 22 caliber rifle sitting next to his toilet in his bathroom. So he would open the window while he was taking time out, and if there were rabbits or something in his backyard, he'd shoot them. But my wife and her sister and my brother-in-law, their brother, Dennis, they never touched that gun. It's amazing. And they grew up with it around the house, fully loaded. And so many, I think, even in this particular audience, if the truth were known, who grew up in a different generation, grew up with the respect that, hey, that's dad's gun or that's mom's gun. Like in my case, my mom had a gun. But nevertheless, my point being is that they're loaded. You don't touch them. You just don't touch them. And if you do touch them, guess what happened? Whoa, that hand would be red for a long time, if you get my point. Because kids are okay if they get spanked. I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying, you're wrong. Don't do that. No. Everybody today, for instance, in Canada, you can't even spank your child. You spank your child in public in Canada, you run the risk of going to jail. That is really what has happened up there. And stay tuned. It's coming down here too. You watch as children gain more rights amongst us. But sadly, the dysfunctionality, and I digress, of family has contributed a lot to the decline and degradation, deterioration of the behavioral patterns of so many of the young and, frankly, even of the adults, the husbands and the wives, because sadly, too many children are having children. And even unfortunately, from my generation, and I'm ashamed to say it, they have grown up themselves being dysfunctional and don't have a clue on how to bring up children. And so consequently, they end up with children that are misbehaved because they themselves don't have any boundaries. They themselves, as adults, don't have an understanding of how to be and what's right and what's wrong. They don't have a good sense, a good core area of values amongst themselves. So it all contributes in many, many cases and in many areas along these lines that just add fodder, as they say, to the fire. But I want to get back now to marriage. And for that matter, in some respects, and again, we're talking in the context of marriage, but in some respects, these particular fundamental underscoring points of love that I'm about to share with all of you apply to friendships as well, within reason. You'll see what I mean in a moment. But in this particular case, these particular four Greek words that are very underscoring to good solid marriages and do define some particulars regarding a successful marriage, of which I want to build on for this particular presentation, is the following. Phileo. Phileo essentially means, it's a Greek word that essentially means friendship. Your marriage should be a friendship. Fundamentally, it should be a good friend. Your husband, your wife, ought to be your best friend. That individual should be the individual that you can truly unzip your skin with, if you know what I mean. I speak that figuratively. For your personality, with whatever might be troubling you, she or he should be your psychiatrist and psychologist, somebody that you need to have around occasionally to bounce something off of, and maybe a decision needs to be made about something that's going to affect both of you especially. You need to talk about it. Friendship. Friends talk. Friends communicate. And when I say talk, it's not what's for dinner talk. You know, it's where's the newspaper, not just that kind of talk. It's how you feeling. It's not always, well, I'm okay, when you're really not. Well, you know what? I'm not okay. Oh boy, here she goes again. Or here he goes again. Well, yeah. If that's what's bothering somebody, guess what? You need to be patient enough to sit down and talk about it. That's friendship. That's friendship. Well, let's talk about it. Let's see if we can work through that. Phileo, friendship is very, very important. And as well, you have in this particular case, many of you are very familiar with agape, which means, of course, affectionate love. But in the way of friendship too, as well as in marriage, this affectionate love should be motivating to the point where it is charitable. It's oriented towards service. In other words, husband and or wife should not be hesitant to make sacrifices because they have an affection that drives them, that motivates them to want to please, to want to serve, to want to make them happy. And so consequently, that becomes an important part of the relationship as well, even in friendships too, in terms of good friends who are willing to sacrifice even on behalf of another friend. But agape is another Greek word that is very indicative and illustrative of that. Now, this is not necessarily for friends, but certainly applies very much so for marriages, and that's eros, the sexual attraction, the romance of a relationship. I've often said when the kissing stops, watch out, beware. It should be good kissing in a healthy marriage. Nice kissing. Affectionate kissing. That should be predicated on agape. Because, let's face it, erotic, eros, that's where it comes from, erotic affection is a good, healthy involvement in a marriage that is certainly solid and based on good mortar, as they would say. You have to have that. If you don't, even the Bible says, don't forbid yourselves for too long, except maybe in fasting occasionally. But don't forbid yourself in that regard and in that area, because it is an important part of the marriage experience for all you singles, because that's what that definitely applies exactly to marriage only in that case. And then, of course, there's a fourth one, Greek word that certainly does illustrate another very important underscoring element to a strong marriage, and that is peao. Peao. Peao means commitment. Because guess what? I'm not going to agree with you all the time, Archie. Guess what? I'm not going to agree with you all the time, Bill. You know, because that's just the way it is. And so we ought to be able to say, well, I disagree. Well, I disagree. I mean, it was a very interesting experience as my wife and I went through the remodeling experience of my home. We had disagreements about what should be done here, what should be done there. And we were able to get through it, but you ought to be able to experience, if need be, even passion and emotion of differences of opinion, but still get through it. In other words, you're not throwing each other under the bus just because I'm mad at you or just because I disagree with you. I'm going to just throw you under the bus as a result. I want a divorce. I quit. Give me my toys. I'm going home. That's it. It's over. Because we're arguing over another burnt dinner or over an issue about, well, I don't want that chandelier there. I want the chandelier over there. Something along those lines. We need to learn to be mature enough, brethren, to pick our battles. and what's really important. Because we could avoid so much stress in our lives if we look at the bigger pictures. Sadly, today, people don't have the patience to get through some of these very basic things that marriage involves, and of which consequently oftentimes causes them to go awry far too quickly, even in spite of children at risk. Because today people really would be more apt to just give up on it, and oftentimes prematurely, if they would just work at it. And again, so many today, because they're not equipped in dealing with how to navigate through some of these conflicts and or some of these interpersonal relations, they fail as they come in contact with or are confronted with these circumstances. Over here in 1 Peter, if you would turn with me for a moment to chapter 3. Here Peter mentions something that I think is very important for all of us to keep in mind, because there is order in marriage. There is certainly particular concepts, views, paradigms that we as men should have toward our ladies, our wives, and we women, or you women, I'm not a woman, should have toward your husbands. What I mean by that is outlooks. There should be some basic fundamental outlooks that premise your paradigm of approach toward your mate, depending on your gender. Peter begins to address some of that here, as he points out in chapter 3 here, 1 Peter chapter 3, to verse 5. For after this manner, in old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. There was that much respect that Sarah would actually have the paradigm to call Abraham, her husband, Lord. Now, in the old setup, the husband was indeed the king of his household. The wife was the queen of her household. And as a result, there was a relationship, a fundamental connection, view, paradigm, framing that the two mates, opposite genders, by the way, man and woman, would have toward one another in this relationship. And here it says, and we are pointed out in verses 5 and 6, a bit of Sarah's paradigm, but then also in verse 7, likewise you husbands. Now notice this. This is a directive to the men. Dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor to your wife. You should honor your wife, you guys. To get to the point where a man literally hauls off and whacks his wife across the face with a closed fist is unconscionable. It's unconscionable. It is so far 180 degrees from ground zero that we, in our society today, because it happens so frequently and it happens so often, especially, unfortunately, among athletes and so on, you hear an awful lot of stories along these lines, that this kind of stuff has become hardened in our hearts. It's almost to the point where we in our society here look at this as being somewhat normal. Well, that just happens. Everybody's doing it. Well, no, not everybody is doing it. And very weak people are doing that, and obviously confused people do that kind of stuff, especially when you see that this is the premise that you should be coming from. A wife who has the paradigm that her husband is a lord, and a husband who honors his wife with respect and esteem. Well, that right there, I'll tell you, that's a tremendous recipe for success and good relations, if the two of them can maintain that, even in the heat of battle and in the heat of confrontation and in the heat of life's dynamics, as I've often said, comes at us quickly. And sometimes we don't think through. Instead, what we do normally, or unfortunately and oftentimes too often, is react. But at any rate, getting back here, and I digress, verse 7, 1 Peter chapter 3, again we read, likewise you husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife, and unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life. And this Weaker vessel is implicit of strength, physical strength, not mental, spiritual. It is obvious ladies, most cases, are not as strong as men. Men were essentially viewed as the stronger, the strength. That would be the stronger cord of the bind of two in that regard. And men should honor that and realize that of the woman and not expect her to help you lift the refrigerator if you need to move it, you know, or things along these lines. And some women, I mean, they can for sure, and don't get me wrong, there's exceptions to every rule. But the general paradigm is, and unfortunately it's sad, that to even say what I'm saying, that a woman would be physically not as strong as a man, or that a man is suited more for doing stronger, more bull and physical work, and a woman is not as well suited for that, is not even politically correct anymore for me to even say that kind of stuff. Why, I would be going, and I'd have the Now gang after me, you know, already chasing me down the street by saying I'm totally wrong, and they'd give me a ton of examples of which I would understand and agree, because it is what it is, it's the reality of our life that we're living. Yet nevertheless, it doesn't dismiss the principle. It doesn't dismiss the principle. Women were not created with the intent that they were to be physically stronger than men in that regard. That's where Peter's coming from in this regard as he begins to address these particular things. Finally, and also I want to point out, being heirs together of grace and life, meaning being heirs together, equally you are capable, female and male, to achieve the same spiritual reward. Therefore, spiritually women are equal with men in potentiality, in personality control, in the ability to be changing behaviors in terms of the conversion process. Absolutely. Men and women, we're human beings. We are of a species called humans. And in that regard, we are equal in that particular sense. I find it amazing how people can say, there's a distinction between this car and that car. This car has these features, and we have no problem making these distinctions of differences in tools, differences in cars, differences in animals. I like a big dog. I like a little dog. Oh, we're not being politically correct because we shouldn't tell the little dog he's a little dog because that'll make him feel bad. But the little dog's a little dog. It is what it is. So you got to tell the little dog he's a little dog and I like little dogs. And that doesn't mean the little dog's less of a dog than the big dog, because the big dog is dog too, but he's just a big dog. And there's distinctions. That's what we're talking about. Females and males, there's distinctions. They're both humans. Spiritually speaking, ladies have the same potential to be born again as spirit beings and glorified in the life after ruling and reigning with Christ and augmented by and certainly Christ implementing and maximizing your skills of management and all the things that you bring to the table that he will need to help him rule in the millennium. That is equal on the table, female and male. But boy, I'll tell you, we are a confused lot when we get into this political correctness and all the things that we try to squeeze to make changes to conform to what we believe is right. Getting back, though, to this premise and to these absolutes here that we're talking about, Peter continues here as he says, and also I want, in mentioning verse 7, that last line, that your prayers be not hindered. I don't want to digress too much in that, but it is important to have these paradigms and to have this peace amongst yourself, because if you don't have a happy home and you're not really together, there's a good chance that your prayers will indeed be hindered. Because if you've got a wife or you've got a husband, you've got a relationship there that God is holding you accountable for. And it is important that there is peace in the home, especially if you as a family are going to want to exceed your own boundaries to minister to others, meaning being other examples, bringing maybe additional whatever blessings and interaction and benefits that other people, your friends and family members might be able to get from you, if you, and you can imagine, haven't got a good family example, how that is indeed going to hinder your impact on them. Because they'll think you're a hypocrite. Plain and simple. Oh, you claim you do this and you do that, but you don't. That kind of stuff, if you know what I'm saying. And certainly prayers can be hindered in those areas as well. And what God is telling us is it's important to get your own house together first before you attempt to really expand yourself, because you could have much more impact if you are really together with your husband and or your wife first. But he goes on here, finally, verse 8, be you all of one mind, having compassion one of another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. Being pitiful doesn't mean to be pity one another. It means basically to be compassionate, be tender-hearted. You know, I mentioned last week about listening to people and being empathetic and being open to their feelings so that you can put yourself in their shoes. Oftentimes, that's not the easiest thing for many of us to do because oftentimes many of us are so very selfish and self-oriented, it's hard for us to project out and put ourselves in that person's shoes. Remember that song, Walk a Mile in My Shoes, I think? It had that lesson involved that if you see a person, you don't know the context of their life. You don't know how they got to that point. So far be it from you to judge that person. That's not right. That's not good. That's not healthy. Instead, if you see somebody in dire straits like that, be empathetic. And especially if you do have a way and a means to help that individual and you have a venue to do that, then shame on you if you don't, you see. And that's important, too, to recognize these particular opportunities that come our way, if indeed they do come our way. But he goes on, love his brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. Verse 9, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing. Why did you do that? Well, I don't know why I didn't do it. What do you think? Bam, 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 bam. You know, and you're raising your voices. First thing you know, you've got a nuclear war going on in the house. And as a result of that, needless to say, nothing gets solved. Basically, everybody gets polarized even more. Somebody has got to be more mature enough to say, time out. Let's get to the issue here. We're going to get into some of these principles here in a minute. I don't want to get ahead of myself because I'm still setting the stage. But in this particular case, as he continues on here, he says, watch this. Don't render evil for evil, railing for railing, but contrariwise. In other words, be different. Blessings. Be contrarian. Be blessing, blissful, knowing that you are there unto called that you should inherit a blessing. For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips, that they speak no guile. You idiot, you dumb buffoon. How could you do that? What do you mean you're calling me an idiot? Why, let me tell you about what you did. And first thing you know, you're at it again like a couple of cats on a hot tin roof. We don't talk like that to our mates, or at least we shouldn't be. And that's what Peter is saying here in this particular context. But again, as I say, you can expand this out even to your church family. You can expand this out even to your friends outside of the church. Because the principles I'm about to share with you are certainly applicable in all of these areas. Goes on here in verse 10, for he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile. Verse 11, now let him eschew, that means to flee, to avoid, to eschew evil, stay away from it. Like Joseph, when Potiphar's wife attempted to seduce him, he wasn't going to have any part of it. So he undid himself from his jacket and literally took off. Even though he was barely clothed underneath that jacket, it was better for him to streak down the streets than to go ahead and take part in what she wanted him to do. He got framed anyway, and she put him in jail for 2 years regardless, but that's another story. My point is, though, in this particular case, he eschewed, and that's the illustration of that story, he eschewed that evil. And do good. Let him seek peace. And follow it. That's what ensue it means. Follow it and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. So it is important that both male and female in the relationship do the best they can in pursuing peace in the household. Now, granted, in many of our cases being in the church, it ought to be easier because from the start, both husband and wife ought to be founded on the same premises because you're all operating from the same owner's man. And so theoretically, and I emphasize theoretically, because sadly, I'm here to tell you, being a minister for some 20 years now, plus, it is not a guarantee. There is divorce in God's church. And that's to our own embarrassment because, sadly, even though we know what we know, many in God's church don't find the way to get through some of this stuff and unfortunately fail in the application of these principles. Others of you are married to unconverted mates, we call them. And
The label in God's church over the years has been those of us who are married to mates that don't share our faith. We call them spiritual widows in the sense that they're not sharing their spiritual faith with their mate. And that presents another set of dynamics and another set of circumstances, but of which just as opposite as it is to guarantee a marriage success with two people in God's church, which it isn't, nor is it to presume doom and gloom to your marriage if one mate is not sharing your faith. Because you can have a very successful marriage, regardless of the inability of the other mate to come to the same level of acceptance of understanding you have of this way of life. So either way, there are no guarantees. That's my point. Either way, there are no guarantees. What can only help you and what can only further assure you of the success of either set of circumstances is the application of these principles that I would like to share with you. Now, by no means are they the only applications, but they would help, certainly as these basic applications present themselves, if indeed they would be applied accordingly. And they may even lead you to other principles that you can apply as you spin off with finding things that will come to your mind and even in the application of it as you apply these particular ones. But point number one, fundamental, very fundamental to relationships, not only with human beings and friends, but especially in the context we're talking about today with your mate. Very, very important. Point number one. Be appreciative of the qualities of your mate. Be appreciative. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let me give you some novel ideas. How about a compliment once in a while? Boy, I like that tie you're wearing, Bill. Man, I haven't heard that in years. Or, boy, I like that dress. Margie, you look hot. I mean, if I compliment friends and I could compliment another lady in a dress, or even a guy for that matter. I've told a couple of guys that I'd like to steal their ties because they were good, nice ties. I like them. I appreciate good ties, you know, for what it's worth. But my point is, these are things, these are principles to use to help bond relationships. Appreciation. Boy, you did a good job. Darren has a coaching responsibility. He's got tons of opportunity to express to his players, good job, good shot, good layup. He's a basketball coach. Those kinds of things. You who are supervisors on your job, you don't know what it means to have an employee receive an accolade or a compliment from the boss. I mean, that does wonders for morale, motivation. Sometimes just a, hey, thank you for meeting that deadline, does wonders for even a relationship between an employee and a supervisor. Something that simple. Be appreciative. Express your appreciation. Compliments. How about flowers, guys? Ladies, how about another tie or another wallet? I don't know. But you know what I'm saying. Once in a while, do something for the husband as well. Oftentimes the guy gets all the heat. You never buy me flowers. You never take me out. You don't buy me dinner. You don't. You're always thinking of yourself. Ladies, it'd be nice once in a while, too, for the guys to get a gift once in a while. I mean, I don't know about flowers, but you be creative in how you think of how your husband might look at that. How about a love note in the lunchbox? You open it up at the job, you know, and she says, wait till you get home tonight, wink, 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 kind of thing. And there's a little flowers in there and stuff. You know, I don't know. But you know what I'm saying. That's for married couples, by the way. That goes back to that eros. But you know what I'm saying? That these are the things that make life interesting. How about spontaneity? What do you mean you want to go to a show? Now I'm not dressed. Just throw some on. Let's go. What do you mean we're going for a weekend? Let's go. I'm not ready. I didn't plan on it. Let's go. Wow. Okay. Forget it. Drop everything. Go. Enjoy it. Be a little daring, adventurous. Be spontaneous. Oftentimes marriages get into ruts where they're not spontaneous anymore. They're just the old drudgery. It's the old thing. Come home at 5 o'clock, sit down in the same chair, do the same thing, watch the same television. You don't ever break that regimen. You never break that pattern. to where finally it's all of a sudden, it gets so intense that you tend to turn on one another occasionally. And it's almost like two animals in a cage that's too small. And first thing you know, you're at each other's throats and you're saying things you don't mean, or you get into more fights than usual. And if you change things up, change the pattern, break the cycle, oftentimes you get a little bit of air. Go to a nice hotel and spend a nice weekend just enjoying each other. Go to a spa and spoil yourselves for a little bit of time on a weekend or so. But these are things that you can certainly add to your own creative thinking on how you could handle this and meet these particular demands in this particular category of being appreciative of the qualities of your mate. And again, because if we don't, we stay too focused on our complaints. And that's what we have to watch. If you find yourself not complimenting a lot, what you will find yourself saying is, we don't never have enough money. You don't ever cook for me. Or you're always burning the food. Or you never pick up after yourself. I wrote down a few here. Not that I do these things. But why do you always do this? Every time you do that, you'll never this, that, or the other thing. This needs to be done. You never fix this. It's always never on, you know. And you constantly hear these things. We need this. We need that. We got to fix it. I asked you 5 weeks ago to get this done, and you still haven't got that. And over and over and over. And that's all you hear week after week, year after year. Guess what? It just draws the life out of that relationship. It will. It'll draw you dry. And first thing you know, you're cruising for a bruising, as they would say, up ahead somewhere along the lines. And you're going to find then that your conflicts are even harder to get through. Because the conflicts will come along, and because you're always hammering on one another, you begin to create other problems that lead us to point number two. And that is treating each other with two words, honor and respect. That's important. Point two, treating each other with honor and respect. Since we're in Peter, turn to 1 Peter chapter 2, and I think it's verse 17. Peter states it here. I'm just going to break into the context. But again, in this paradigm, this framing we're talking about today, Peter references it as honoring all men. It could be esteem all men, love the brotherhood, that's the church, fear God, and honor the leadership. Honor the president, the vice president, the Congress, your leaders, your mayor. Honor them for the roles that they serve in. And I know many of us have a hard time doing that. Keep in mind, this early New Testament church, when Peter was appealing for those Christians to honor their leadership, and he goes in other areas too about that as well in other books, I think it is in Romans, he was actually under the heel of the Roman Empire, one of the most corrupt governments and empires that ever existed on planet Earth at the times of these writings, and these guys were saying, honor your leaders. Honor your leaders. But getting back to our topic, honor your wife. Honor your husband. Respect your husband. Respect your wife. Those are important things. And when you do that, you see, then it becomes a little bit interesting. Because if you really have respect for the wife, you will attempt to be diplomatic. You will attempt to be honorable. What does honorable mean? Polite. Instead of, let's ever do this! It'll be, you know, sweetheart, boy, I've been thinking about this. And then you try to launch into a discussion, perhaps, and try to get an agreement about it. And you talk. And at the same time you're talking, you attempt to build relationships. Well, you're not attempting, you are building relationships, because guess what you're doing? You're treating each other with honor. How can you get mad at somebody who treats you with honor and respect? You can't. It diffuses the argument. What happens is when we lose our temper and we raise our voice, we get in each other's face and we go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then all of a sudden, whoa, what do? Natural defense is to go defensive. And once your mate goes defensive, nobody's listening anymore, you see. That's what happens. You know it as well as I do. Once your friend goes defensive, if you've got an issue with a friend, and you try to work out that issue with a friend, and why is it we feel and we're motivated more to attempt to work through a conflict with a friend and walk on the eggshells and take the effort to maneuver and to discuss and to be diplomatic and tactful and all those things with a friend. And yet we will slam our mate in a New York Minute. And you go back, the old adage, well, you always hurt the one you love. No, you don't. No, you don't. That's a wives' tale. That's a myth. You don't hurt the ones you love. We do. But that's an illustration of the fact that we're taking our loved one for granted. And that's important. We guard against and not allow that to happen. Honor and respect. Express appreciation. Treat each other with honor and respect. That's point two. Very important element. And certainly something that we need to keep in mind as we go forward in our relationships, especially when we're considering on bringing another individual into our life and committing to spending the rest of our life with that individual. Until death do we part. Now that is commitment. Marriage, brethren, marriage is the second most important decision you will ever make in your life. The first and most important decision is a decision to commit your life to Jesus Christ. That's the most important decision that you'll ever make. But marriage, believe you me, to commit yourself to another individual of the opposite sex, by the way, is a very, very critical decision. And it's not for kids. That's the sad part about it. It's not for a 14-year-old to make that decision. And yet we have 14-year-olds jumping in bed, getting involved in eros. Getting involved in eros. You talk about putting the cart in front of the horse. 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds that are already becoming fathers and mothers don't know the first thing themselves about their life, let alone bringing a baby into this world. And now being saddled with the responsibility, but usually that doesn't happen. It goes to mom, who's the grandma. And they end up bringing the child up. And that's unfortunately what's happening in our society. It's happening too much. And consequently, we're losing our fiber. We're losing our adhesion to sensibility and to reasonableness. And it's fraying. It's becoming unraveled. And we're seeing it. We just saw what? Another shooting in a school here the other day, I think it was. Was it not in California? In California, another shooting. This is symptomatic. It is symptomatic of a much greater and bigger problem. And part of it is a major issue where it resolves right with the breakdown of the family. Dysfunctional people having kids, or too young having children. But that's just another way of saying they're dysfunctional too, because youth can be very dysfunctional because they're still in search of their own selves and their own identity. Point number three, though, and this is very important as well, because at some point you are going to come up on a disagreement that is perhaps going to be offensive to one another. I've been married now almost for 42 years, and I can tell you, Margie and I have had a few fights. I mean, that's just the way it is. Have I been offended from things that Margie has done to me? Probably. Has she been offended from things that I've done to her? Absolutely not. No, I'm just kidding. But, yeah, probably. No, actually, I know for sure. But the reality of it is, this now, point three, has to be part of the ingredients if you want a successful marriage, because at some point, you're going to trip. And at some point, somebody's going to be on their face, figuratively speaking, in the mud, and they're not going to get up. Because they've been offended. And somebody's got to say, I'm sorry. In other words, point three, be forgiving. Don't hold a grudge. Be forgiving. Don't, while they're down, kick them some more. That's your mate. Man, I'm sorry. And then respect and honor. Get back to respect and honor and go back at it and attempt to try to recover where the breakdown occurred. That's so very, very important. Notice over here in Hebrews. Go to Hebrews 4 for a moment here in chapter 12 real quickly. Verse 14. Follow peace with all men. And that means everybody, including your mate. Including your mate. Oftentimes, you know, we're always thinking about our friends. We're always thinking about people in the church. Let's frame this in marriage, because marriage, our mates are included in this statement. Our mates are people. Our mates are men and women. And so let's keep that in mind here. Verse 14, follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see God, looking diligently, lest any man fail of or fall from, the Greek could also be translated, fall from grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. And then he proceeds to show an example of Esau, who was so embittered over the fact that he lost his birthright to Jacob that he could not find in his own heart to forgive his brother. And as a result, found no place, that's what that means, no place of repentance, because he in his own self, within himself, would and could not find the empathy and the compassion to forgive his brother for what he did. And therein lies when a root of bitterness sets in, because once that occurs, brethren, to make that step to forgive and to help that person up that you've offended or that has been offended becomes almost an impossibility. Because now you're talking about psychological changes that you've closed the door on, of which now, emotionally speaking, is hard to break through. Because those stumbling blocks, those emotional, in some cases, they could even be demonic, but those emotional blocks erect walls that are very hard to penetrate, emotionally speaking. And you yourself grapple and struggle for access through whatever keyhole that could be accessed to get through that. And oftentimes, in this case, especially if bitterness sets in, it's virtually almost, according to your Bible, an impossibility. And if there's bitterness involved, what you've got to do is get at the issue first, get rid of the bitterness, so then you can get on with addressing the issues. Because until many cases, like when you're counseling an alcoholic, or some other type of addiction of sort, in order to really get the breakthroughs that you're looking for that are going to be of any substance, you've got to get them sober. And until you can get through that issue, the substance of all the other issues are really, at this point, moot. You've got to get them sober. You've got to get through the block first. Once you get through the block, then you open up into the arena of the other issues that now can be addressed and strategized to be resolved. And so it is with bitterness. Once bitterness sets in, boy, I'll tell you, you've got a real uphill battle to get rid of that before you can really even get into the resolving of the issues. And much of this deals with conflict resolution. That's a whole sermon in itself, of which perhaps maybe it's another point we can get into that and just spend some time just on this one conflict resolution, especially in marriages, but conflict resolution even in relationships of friends. But suffice it to say, and let me add these particular things, 3 points in resolving conflicts with yourself. And that is to, number one, stay focused on the issue. That's one of the hardest things to do. When you are in an argument about whatever that issue may be, discipline yourself to stay on point. Do not allow yourself to digress or deflect. That's a technique in debate, deflect. A lot of politicians always use that. You saw a lot of that being done in the debates between Mitt Romney and now President Obama in regards to deflecting off the issues and not answering the question. You ever notice how they deflect that? They never answer the question. You sit there and you say, answer the question. And then unfortunately, the guys that are doing the interviews, guess what? They take the bait and they let it go. They cut them to slack. When I've often said, no, get back on the issue. Get back on the point. Make them address that question, you know, I'm trying to turn my TV to get them to that point. And then I end up throwing socks at the TV because they never do get back to the point. But in this particular case, understand that in conflict resolution, point number one, stick to the issues. Minimize, if not eliminate, your digressions. And number two, don't use the words. 2 words. Do not use these if you're attempting. Now, if you want to incite conflict, then use them. But if you want to resolve the conflict,
Don't use these words if you want to resolve it. Don't use the word always. You always do this. No, I don't always do this. You never, that's word number two, never. Do not use the words in your conflicts when you're trying to resolve. Do not use the word always and never. If you don't remember anything about this particular point, remember those two words. Do not use them because that's unfair to the one that you're trying to resolve your issue with. And thirdly, this is the third point, resolve your disagreement as soon as possible, preferably according to the Bible, preferably before the sun sets. Now, keep in mind, there's a fourth point. Make sure you have time. Timing is really of the essence. That's the fourth point. Do not argue on something that is going to encroach and make a bad situation worse because you've got another appointment or something that's pressing you. Agree to, hold it, time out, let's table this until tomorrow or whatever. That's okay because now you're both agreed to go ahead and do that. This may sound fundamental, but they work. They work. It's important that we do treat each other with this kind of respect and this kind of honor and esteem. But at any rate, that's all part of forgiving. Conflict resolution is all part of the forgiving point of which we've covered, and forgiveness being point number three. So we've got expressing appreciation and qualities of your mate, and of course point two, treat each other with honor and respect, and point three is be forgiving in your involvement, especially when conflicts arise. Be always willing to work through that by forgiving and restarting whatever needs to be restarted so that you can redress the issues. And then, point four, have the concept or have the point of view, have the approach toward this, and that is to be helpful, positive, and constructive. In other words, you're not arguing to tear down, cut their legs out from under them, put their nose up, give them a bloody nose or whatever. You're not intending to do that. What you're intending to do is really try to come through this a bit better and bigger and stronger for whatever this issue may be that you're dealing with. And if you both enter into that, obviously with that in mind, then that can be something that can be very, very helpful in your relationship, because you have to, in some cases, be willing, though, of course, to bare your souls. Because if you're going to get involved with being helpful and constructive and positive in your approach as you resolve these things and deal with each other, you're going to have to be honest. You're going to have to be open. You're going to have to bare your souls. And this goes to that point, remember, of phileo, to be friends. To be friends. If you're my friend, then I trust you with what I'm going to say. It's a terrible thing for your mate to be a power broker over you, and when you disclose a weakness, they turn it around and bang you on the head with it and say, "See, I told you you were that way." Well, guess what? I am that way. So help me out. I am that way. Help me out here. I'm not perfect. But oftentimes, what we end up doing is say, "Well, yeah, I might be that way, but let me tell you about you." And then we get in this, and boom, it's just one fodder after another, and the fire just gets hotter and hotter, and the flames get higher and higher. And first thing you know, you're at opposite ends of the field, as they would say. You're polarized. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4, it states, and I'm just going to reference it because I've got time running out on me here. Love is kind. Translated also, love is constructive, not destructive. Love is constructive, not destructive. And chapter 13, verse 5, that was, first one was 13, verse 4, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 5, seeks not its own. In other words, it's willing, remember sacrifice, agape, I'm willing to sacrifice and concede a point for peace. Fine, let's have it your way, no problem, let's go on. In other words, be strategic in picking your battles and where you're going to dig in. Be strategic. Really count the costs. Understand really what's important here and how important it might be to the other. But be very, very understanding over the fact that love does not seek its own. And for us who basically and fundamentally vary in degrees of narcissism, brethren, that's something all of us need to understand. We are selfish people.
in our base nature. And that's a lot of what we are fighting within ourselves, to get rid of some of that selfishness. True love, to be married and have somebody that you trust, that you can bear your heart with, that you can sit down in the quietness of your home, stone sober, not drunk, stone sober, and be able to communicate, heart to heart, mind to mind. What a blessing that is to have. And that's an individual that you want to honor, you want to respect, as weak as they may be, as flawed as they may be, as buffooning as they may be. The fact of it is, that still, if that individual loves you so much that they're willing to give of themselves in that area, my, oh my, handle that piece of china gently, gingerly, with respect and honor, because that is a great prize that one can have. And this, number five, this is the last point, number five, and that is always remember that this is a team. It is a team. You are a team. And together you should be stronger. Together your life should be bigger, better, and in many respects more varied for the benefit of you, and if you have children and bring them into the world, for them too as well. What a beautiful environment it is to have children brought into a nurturing condition, a home, not a house, a home, where mom and dad are there, they care about the children or the child, and they're doing what they can, and the child respects that and sees that because the child understands that it's reciprocal. If mom and dad get along, then, wow, that means it's good for me too. So that's where honor your mom and your dad, young people, come in. You honor mom and dad, but then that also means mom and dad have to be honorable. Honorable. It's a two-way street. And so is respect and honor as well. And so it's important for us to grasp these things. So marriage is, as I say, something that I think all of us need to really cherish, brethren. We really do. We need to cherish it. Not enough people do cherish marriage. As a matter of fact, many people today look at marriage as an institution, a secular contract, an agreement. For the life of me, you know, I've often said, if I didn't have God in my life, I would really have to look at marriage wondering, why would I get married? And that's what, unfortunately, a lot of young people are doing today. A lot of people are looking at the institution itself, trying to redefine it in one case, or in a major case with the homosexual community, where they continue to depreciate and debase the value of a God-ordained institution. And that's, unfortunately, a dynamic and a major dimension in marriage today that's missing. It has lost, that is, the institution has lost its connection and meaning with God. When one realizes that marriage is the physical microcosm of what God has going with on the spiritual level with His church, that puts a whole new stamp of value on that relationship. As physical and as basic, fundamental, of two mortal human beings interacting and talking mechanically and eating and sleeping and working and doing all the things that we do as humans in life, it is a very, very holy, holy and sacred institution. And we should, certainly with being and having the opportunity to function in a relationship like that, respect it, honor it, appreciate it, make sacrifices for it, and do the best you can to do what you can to assure God's blessings in it.